I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
Hello, welcome to the Functional Nerds Podcast. My name is John Anilio, and this is a very unique episode of the Functional Nerds Podcast. If you're a regular listener, you can already tell that it's unique. Patrick Hester is not here today. He is in the middle of a family emergency, so he could not be here today. I think everything is going pretty well right now, but he had a hell of a week, so he will not be joining us today. Filling in for Patrick Hester is Christy Cherish. She is the author of The Owl and the Japanese Circus, and she is also the co-host of the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing podcast, amongst other things. Christy, say hello.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for filling in, especially last minute. I'm very appreciative, and I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy you today, even though Patrick isn't joining us for that. So thank you for coming on, Christy. I really do appreciate it. And our guest today, very special guest, is Dr. Travis Langley. He is a psychologist. He's a professor at, I believe, Henderson University. And he's got several books out, and including his new one, which is called Dark Side of the Mind, Star Wars Psychology. And it is a bunch of different articles, some that Dr. Langley wrote himself and with some other psychologists in here. And it's a great book. I'm about three quarters of the way through in it and very much enjoying it. And we're happy to have him today. Hello, Dr. Langley. Thank you for coming on.
Hello. One thing I'll point out that confuses everybody, because they put the subtitle above the title, oddly enough. So it's actually Star Wars Psychology, Dark Side of the Mind.
Yeah, I was thinking of that as I was reading. I'm like, it's probably the other way around, even though
it looks like it's a Dark Side of the Mind, Star Wars Psychology, because the subtitle's up at top. It's like it's its own logo. I can see visually why, but from the future books for Game of Thrones psychology, the mind is dark and full of terrors. We'd be down at the bottom. For Star Trek psychology, the mental frontier will be at the bottom. So we're going to stop confusing people after that. I never thought it should be mixed up like that.
Yeah. Well, and one thing I do want to tell our listeners before we continue on, Dr. Langley has a hard out, as we refer to in the biz. So we're going to do a slightly different format today where we're going to do our picks last. So we're going to do sort of our main interview first with Dr. Langley, and then we're going to do our picks, and we will let Dr. Langley go, and Christy and I will then talk about some of our picks later on. So, Dr. Langley, this was kind of a no-brainer book, and as a guest, Artie Allspach, who was one of the publicists at Tor for a long time, now works for Sterling Books in New York, and she'd emailed me saying, like, hey, I have this book. It's Star Wars and Psychology, and I love Star Wars, and being a teacher, I also have quite an interest in psychology, and my wife is a psychologist, so I'm like, yes, send me that book, and yes, I would like to get Dr. Langley on the show. So how many books do you currently have out that are sort of in this kind of series of pop culture or science fiction and fantasy sort of wedded with these psychological concepts?
Well, I've got three out. I wrote Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night. I was the sole author on that one. That came out about 3.5 years ago and is still popular, still doing well every single week. The new books for this year that was starting, I'm not the sole author. I write a lot, but I bring together other, you know, psych geeks that I've gotten to know over the last few years. These are people that I've done convention panels with or my fellow Psychology Today bloggers, so that I know they know how to talk about their psychology and the popular culture topic, to do it for a general audience so it makes sense and is interesting, and how to do it quickly. And so for this year, we had The Walking Dead Psychology, Psych of the Living Dead, which had a foreword by John Russo, who invented George Romero's zombies. and now we've got Star Wars Psychology. And then for next year, we've got four scheduled to come out. I've already mentioned two of them. There's also Captain America versus Iron Man, Freedom, Security, Psychology. And they haven't announced the title for the one later next year. So there may be one involving a guy with a TARDIS, but, you know, I don't know. They haven't announced it yet, so I'm not going to say the title, even though that sounds a little silly once I've made it clear what I'm talking. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you don't care.
If they don't know what you're talking about, they're probably not a listener on this show.
True. Now, there's a lot of great, as I said, I'm about three quarters of the way through it. And I went on sort of as regular listeners of the show know, I often, when we do our picks, I'll often pick various psychology books that I've been reading over the summer. I read a couple of books by, I'm going to kill his name, is I believe it's Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. He wrote the book Flow, amongst others. Yeah. And so I'm sort of always on a journey with psychology myself. I'm very kind of reflective on different things. And there's a lot of different concepts like that. And here, one of the ones was an article that you wrote, and you wrote about being an ambivert. So I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that concept of what an ambivert is.
Well, everybody's heard the phrase introvert and extrovert, and they got a basic sense of what it means, although it's a little more complicated than most people think it is. But an extrovert is a very outgoing person, you know, somebody whose attention is externally focused. They tend to be a bit more fearless. So there are a whole lot of qualities that go with that. The introvert would be at the other end of that, the person who is shyer. Their attention is more inwardly focused. You know, they're a bit more nervous, especially things regarding behavior, interacting with other people. The ambivert, it's like the word ambidextrous. If somebody's ambidextrous, they use both hands. The ambivert has both introverted and extroverted qualities, and most of us are ambiverts of some kind or another. You know, you may be more introverted than extroverted or vice versa, but almost nobody has only introverted traits or only extroverted traits. You know, we're mixtures, we're complicated creatures. It's one of the things when you'll have some of these tests, you'll take, which Harry Potter character are you, and so forth. They're basing it on just dichotomizing things like introvert and extrovert. So it's like, okay, your score was 1% in the extrovert direction. We're just splitting you and making you whatever extroverted characters we're talking about. So it dumbs down things when they treat them all as just one extreme or another. Hey, that sounds like Congress.
Now, in your article, how does that concept relate to the Star Wars universe?
Well, there are a lot of outgoing characters, you know, for them to have the interest in going out there and doing things and interacting. But you'll notice that the Jedi philosophy is very inward directed, you know, focus on your inner qualities, get inner peace, you know, look into yourself. And so there's one aspect. You know, Princess Leia, she's an outgoing person. That's part of her success, is that she's able to interact with other people, be socially interactive. Her mother was a very outgoing person, though not quite as outgoing as Leia herself. And Yoda, he's off there training Luke in the swamp, while the others are going off to this cloud city where, hey, there's the very outgoing Lando Calrissian, although that wasn't where I use him as the example. I use him as the example somewhere else. Actually, a little more Lando than I'd expected to be in their book. once we go into – well, there's a whole chapter on Lando Calrissian's ethical choice, you know, what he goes through on deciding to, you know, try to get along with the Emperor, betray – Han, and then decide, okay, the deal's going wrong with the Emperor, I'll turn on the Emperor. And when the author told me he wanted to write one about Lando, my reaction was just, you want to write about Lando? But it's a really good chapter. And then I ended up writing about Lando myself on the agreeableness versus disagreeableness feature, because there's this other personality factor. Like, you know, you hear of extroversion and introversion, but there are a number of different factors like that. One is called agreeableness, which I don't like the name because it sounds like you're trying to get along with everybody and just say yes to everything. And while that is more likely, yeah. But there's more to it than that. It's more an old sense of the phrase. You know, somebody's a very agreeable fellow. Well, in the 19th century, you're calling them likable. Some psychologists will define agreeableness as likability, but as I point out in the book, which you might not be at this point yet, it's they're not synonymous. Lando Calrissian, you know, he's trying very hard to get along with the Empire, and then, okay, he's going to get along with the Rebels instead. He's very motivated to be agreeable, outgoing, charming, and get along with others. Jar Jar Binks is also very motivated to get along with everybody and not what most people would call likable.
Certainly not. You know, oh, I'm sorry, Chris, did you have a question? I was about to cut you off.
Yeah, no, it's you know, Lando's kind of one of those odd characters. I wonder if when they did Empire Strikes Back, if they thought he was going to be, you know, a mainstay in the series like he is. He's he's almost the character that I relate to most. And it's because he seems to make the most realistic decisions. Like everybody else is kind of like an, is kind of like an archetype. Like you're the hero or you're the villain. And I remember watching the movies as a kid and going, yeah, you know, I understand why he's doing that. I bet most people would behave like that.
Of course, Lucas didn't write Empire Strikes Back. You know, when he wrote the movie that was originally just called Star Wars, you know, late, 4 years later, renamed A New Hope, you know, he was deliberately pulling archetypes. Psychology shaped Star Wars. People who really know the background know this already. You know, Lucas had many influences, Kurosawa films, Westerns, classic literature of many kinds, but he was having trouble finishing his story until he discovered the works of Joseph Campbell. And through that, the hero's journey and Jungian archetypes. So when he saw these, he went, I was like, this is the kind of story I'm telling. And he deliberately wove archetypes into that first story. And so the next film with a different writer, Lucas on the story, certainly, but somebody else wrote the actual script. And that may be why you see some nuances to Lando, because he wasn't based on an archetype.
And, you know, one of the other points that you brought up, and there is a piece in the book about Princess Leia and how she changes once you get to Empire Strikes Back, and how you talked about the Jungian archetypes and the Joseph Campbell hero's journey, about how there is a woman's hero's journey, which is different from your typical male hero's journey, and how that starts to get explored for Princess Leia in the second movie. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, a number of different writers have speculated and contemplated, well, is there a heroine's journey? Because if you look at the classic stories with heroines, they don't follow that pattern that Campbell talked about as well. And there seem to be some other things going on. I know my writer, Mara Wood, she focused on one view in particular, but there's some other writers who've contemplated a possible heroine's journey as well. And even when this was brought up to Campbell, he just kind of blew it off. It was like, was Campbell being sexist or just not as concerned about the literature? But yeah, they don't fit it as well. Although in some ways they can. You know, you look at Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She fits, you know, the classic model really well. You know, that call to adventure, the refusal to the call, the acceptance, the training, descending into, you know, the darkness. You know, with Buffy, that's dying twice. You know, returning and being aloof and distanced from others, but you know, having this gift at the end with her, it's going to be a big axe toward the end. She actually fits it really well. So it's sometimes with these models, though, it's very easy for us to go through and make things fit the model, where you selectively choose bits and pieces throughout the entire story to show, oh, here's how they fit the model. But it's still, there's something about this model that appeals to people worldwide so that it resonates with us somehow.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of a book that I read, even though I'm not an author. I read a book by James Frey, not like the famous Oprah James Frey. There's another
one. Oh, okay. That was my first thought.
Yeah, no, I think it's James N. Frey. He goes with his middle initial, too, to try to avoid confusion. He's been around for a long time.
It's a really large James, gigantic N. Frey. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, he wrote these How to Write a Damn Good Novel books, and one of the books is called The Key, and it's how you can structure a novel utilizing the hero's journey and how you can utilize those archetypes and utilize sort of key points, as you were saying, you know, the refusal to the call and all of that. And another book that sort of uses that too is Save the Cat, Snyder.
That is a wonderful book.
is that the idea where if you have somebody who's an antihero or maybe not likable, save a pet or be nice to a pet, it makes them more, I don't know, agreeable to your audience?
Well, some of the idea that you really need a save the cat moment with most of your protagonist and maybe some other characters where you need to have something for us to care what they do, even if they are a bit on the bad side, they knew have done something nice, like save a cat early in the story. My son Alex, you know, who's got his fourth book deal now, he loves that book. He will talk about what a wonderful thing it is for writing tips.
Yeah, it's a very streamlined, straightforward. I mean, Save the Cat is a great title. It's a little misleading because that's like one little point in the book. It really goes into how you can structure, and it's specifically for screenplays, but novelists can use it as well. And it gives you really all of these sort of hit points and how to. It's great if you know, for the authors that are in our audience. If you have not read that book, it's a quick read, and again, I'm not an author, but I got a lot out of that book, just in terms of how you can structure a story, no matter what kind of story it is.
People just have to be careful when they're following those deliberate structures, mm-hmm. that they're not getting into an excessively recognizable pattern. When Lucas did it, it had not been shipping movies yet. Obviously, you know, whatever there is that's been influencing people for thousands of years to do these common elements and stories was there. Jung and Campbell, they felt it was in the collective unconscious. Maybe it's just life experiences teaching us this is how things tend to go. But there is something there with that pattern over time. But once you start deliberately weaving story after story to fit the pattern, you could fall into a rhythm that everybody recognizes too well. So sometimes you also have to deliberately mess with people. Some stories do a really good job of setting things up where they're following the pattern, and then they violate it in a key way, in a way that throws you off, but without cheating. As opposed to just, oh, and then, you know, the cavalry arrives when nobody mentioned they were on their way. No, don't cheat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I think that's particularly within epic fantasy novels of, you know, kind of our more modern ones. A lot of them are about utilizing that structure, but by playing with it and going against it and having a different... Because, yeah, you're right. If you're reading a story that is just following that by the numbers, it can be too predictable and therefore quite bland.
Like so many buddy cop films where they've got such a specific pattern. Okay, now come along the other guys. Now they're going to squabble. Oh, now they've learned respect. Now it's moving into Act 3 where it needs to be personalized. It's like, come on. Although, there are a few that deconstruct it. One that Michael J. Fox did with James Wood. You know, Michael J. Fox's character was an actor who outright said, no, come on, this thing has to happen. We're moving into the third act.
that's great. Well, you know, we are getting up near Dr. Langley's out. So, you know, before we get into our picks, I want to thank Dr. Langley for coming on. And maybe when your next book comes out, we can get you on again and perhaps even one of the other contributors to the book. Now, is the next book going to have, are you going to be editing it and is going to be several contributors to it?
Yeah, that's what we're doing for a while. I'm not doing, we're so busy with these. I will do some more single author books, but you know, not in 2016. Yeah, so the next one is Game of Thrones in March. And April, we've got Captain America versus Iron Man. And then at the start of summer, Star Trek Psychology. And then August or fall, I know they want August for the Blue Box book, but I'm saying I think we've got to do it later because of the pace we're doing these other things. But yeah, it'll be different. I would love to bring in some of the other contributors. You know, then we can let them talk and save my throat. And also not bore readers who might have heard me say some of these things elsewhere.
Sure. All right, well, then let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Dr. Langley, why don't you go first with your pick this week?
Oh, my pick of the week is the Kickstarter to bring back Mystery Science Theater 3000. Joel Hodgson has got a very successful Kickstarter going so far. It's just a few days in. It's at 1.7 million out of its $2 million goal to have at least a short season of 3 episodes. And then for every 1.1 million above that, they'll do an additional 3 up to a maximum number of 12 episodes. Actually, he's indicated that's not necessarily the maximum, but that's a target. It's to try to get a full season of 12 episodes. No. And I am just, it is time. There are people riff things all the time all over YouTube and everywhere. And, you know, these guys invented this stuff to the point that it may drive you crazy when you're sitting in a theater and somebody thinks they're at home watching Mystery Science Theater because they're making their own jokes.
Now, is this going to, now, are these going to be where they actually get rights to the movie so that they can actually release it as when the show was on air, where they actually had the you know, would show the movie to, because I know they've done like the riff tracks for quite a while where, you know, you would just sync it up yourself. So is this going to be where they actually get the rights to the movie?
It'll be where they'll have the rights. So it's because some of the earliest Mystery Science Theaters are hard to get because, you know, there was just this little feature that they were doing while showing movies on a channel, and then they didn't actually have the rights to distribute it in that form later on. Most Mystery Science Theater episodes, you can see the full movie and them riffing on it, but there are a few of the early ones where they didn't have it, but you know, they learned a long time ago to get the rights. So, you know, it's not like Riff Tracks where they make the audio and you play it with the movie, which is a really clever way of doing it, so they don't have to get the rights. But no, this will be, it'll be just Mystery Science Theater with, you know, Crow and Tom Servo, though with a new host and a new mad scientist. Joel and others who from the original will be involved.
And I think that show really shaped a lot of kind of modern sensibilities in terms of humor. I think a lot of the kinds of humor that you see out there, especially sort of in geek culture or nerd culture, I think a lot of that was shaped by Mystery Science Theater.
I do think so. It's amazing the things that they did. And, you know, hit or miss on the jokes, but they keep so many of the jokes going. And they trained people not just to crack jokes, but to bring in something smart as well. Not just smart aleck, but smart.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, Dr. Langley has to get going. So, Dr. Langley, before you do go, why don't you tell our listeners your website, your Twitter handle, and maybe any upcoming con appearances or anything else where they can connect with you?
Well, I am at Superherologist on Twitter. I'm easy to find there. I'm on Facebook, you know, Dr. Travis Langley. The books are easy to find there in bookstores all over the place, especially Barnes & Noble. Websites, Barnes & Noble or Amazon, they're all over the place. My calendar ends and begins with San Diego Comic-Con, but I do a lot of other conventions all along the way. Although I'm done with calendars, I'm done with conventions for this calendar year. I don't yet know what some of my schedule will be for the spring, but I'll be doing WonderCon. I love doing these conventions. That's how I get to know other people, including my fellow writers.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Well, Dr. Langley, we will let you go. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, and best of luck with the book.
Oh, thank you.
All right. So that was Dr. Langley. We hope you enjoyed that interview. So now Christy and I are going to get into our picks. And before we do that, I do want to take a moment to thank our patrons. Patrick and I started a Patreon page about a month or so ago, and we are really overwhelmed by the support of our listeners. We now have 34 patrons, I believe. We're making over $100 per month, people that are pledging to this, and it's really changed the way we look at it, with the way we approach it. It has really revitalized us. It has validated what we do. Not so much the money, but just that people are willing to do it, like to commit. I think, you know, that phrase, put your money where your mouth is really, it really means something. And Patrick and I are just so touched by it. And we want to especially thank the 34 people that are already donating, or I shouldn't say donating, but just pledging to support us by the month. And if you enjoy the show and you get value out of the show and you are informed and or entertained by the show each week, consider becoming one of our patrons. You can do $1 a month. We pretty much do the show every week, so that comes out to 25 cents an episode. So is the show worth 25 cents an episode to you? I hope it is. Go check it out too, because there are perks to it as well. You could sit in on the live Google Hangout with it, although we haven't made that happen yet, but it should be happening soon, the next round of interviews. And
if they're on, sorry, I'm interrupting you. If they are watching, so if they're able to do the live feed, does that mean they get the video too?
Yes. So, I've been sure to tell our guests, even though it hasn't happened yet, that are you cool with whoever is our patron? I believe it's at the $5 level. So if you're donating at the $5 a month level, then you can sit in on the live stream. They would just be viewers though, not participants in the live stream, but they can watch. And so I want to make sure everybody is cool with that, because we've had guests that are a little nervous about the video, even when it's just the three of us, where they've made sure that they clean up their room behind them. time and make sure, you know, I don't know, whatever, that they look presentable. I however they want to go about it. But
and think about it this way. It's the, like, I mean, because I'm on the West Coast, and this is, I love doing podcasts in the morning because I sit there in my pajamas with my, you know, with my mic on and drinking my coffee. And I remember I did a bit of a quick take this morning where I was like, oh man, there's video. I better get dressed.
Yeah, well, for today, it's just us. We didn't, because I've never done the recording before, so I was very nervous about that technical part of it, and I'm just like, we haven't made the live stream happen yet, and I can't handle, I can't deal, I have too much to deal with, so I didn't want to do it, so I emailed it. But anyway, so thank you to our patrons, and if you're someone who listens to the show and likes it, consider becoming a patron as well. So let's get on to the rest of our picks. So Christy, what is your pick this week?
All right, so I just have to pull it up because I want to make sure I get all the titles right. So this is a series I've actually been reading lately, and it is called the series is called The Throne of Glass by Sarah J. Maas, and it's YA, which is not really the genre I tend to read. I did when I was a teenager because I was a teenager, but I found that. Not a lot of YA can really keep me interested for the whole series. So this one, it's four books so far. Throne of Glass, Crown of Midnight, Hair of Fire, and Queen of Shadows, which was just released this September. And it's high fantasy YA with a female protagonist from Bloomsbury. And it's one of these series where, regardless of whether or not you're a teen or you're reading with teens or you're a teacher, it's just a good fantasy book and a fantasy series. So it's supposed to be, so the premise is, Throne of Glass, the first book, it follows Selena Sardothian, who's an 18-year-old female assassin in the kingdom of Ardalan. And upon being imprisoned by the rulers in a prison camp, she accepts an offer to compete with other killers in the Glass Castle, so the kingdom's castle, for a chance to serve the kingdom as the king's champion, or the king's assassin is what it really is. And so it sort of it leads her to form some interesting friendships with some of the other players, you know, in the kingdom and in the palace. And is as the series progresses, she gets drawn into a conspiracy in a series of battles and trying to decide how she wants to fit into this kingdom and, you know, how she wants to play into it. I found out it was inspired by Cinderella after I read the series. And that really threw me off. And I was kind of a bit insulted afterwards, finding out that the inspiration had been in Cinderella, until I sort of thought about it. And, you know, if you consider it maybe being, you know, a very incredibly warped and dark version, or, you know, if maybe the inspiration was Cinderella, I kind of like to think that Sarah hated it with a deep-rooted dark passion and kind of wrote the series as a giant, you know, FU to the Disney Cinderella genre, because it's so not. It's a fantastic female protagonist in the sense that she's very much, she's not feminine. She's not waiting for anybody to save her. She's, you know, she's the assassin. She's the one who knows how to kill people. She's, you know, she's the one in charge in a lot of ways. And, she's the one who's trying to take charge of a lot of her situations that are thrown upon her, and dealing with the fact that she doesn't always have full control. So it's a great series. It really surprised me.
Cool. Yeah. It's almost like it brings into mind what we were talking about with Dr. Langley, because there is an interesting chapter in that book of his about, the heroine's journey.
Yeah.
And I think it could be different. You could make it, you know, as same as the heroes, but, you know, even, you know, we were in the book, they talk about how Princess Leia in the initial Star Wars movie is the princess archetype in a lot of ways. You know, she's wearing white. She's very, Luke and Han both sort of talk down to her a little bit when they, well, obviously Han does, but even Luke to a certain extent is kind of dismissive of her ideas upon their first meetings. And then by the time, and then of course she asserts herself in that movie, but definitely by the time you get to Empire Strikes Back, it's a different character. It's much more, empowered character than is in the beginning. So you do see this quite a lot. So how many books are in that series that you just mentioned?
There's four so far, but it looks like they're planning about six. Okay. So it's by no means over yet. And it's been on sale quite a bit, ebook wise, because the fourth book came out. So they're of course trying to get new readers or, you know, and such. So, but yeah, it not a lot of YA surprises me nowadays, because it tends to follow it, you know, kind of like Dr. Langley was talking about though. And, you know, there are those archetypes that we've started to use, you know, very repetitively in, you know, in particular genres, YA being one of them, you know, especially with sort of the type of journey that, you know, authors tend to expect YA readers want. And this one sort of veers from that quite a bit in some original ways. So it's with the holiday season coming up, you know, that's one that if you wanted to binge read something, that's one I would recommend.
Cool. Yeah, I think with YA, because I do read a little bit of it, and I think sometimes with YA, it's so effective, because I think one of the things that they do that non-YA books sometimes have trouble with is they are often very clear with the story. Like, I read Joe Abercrombie's Half a King, which is technically YA. And I think, I don't know exactly why it's YA. I mean, I guess it's not as bloody as some of his other books are. But I thought that was a masterpiece, that book. I just thought it was so clear and, you know, lots of twists and everything. But I just found it, because I love me a big 1,000-page epic fantasy, but you can get very lost in those books. And that's a pro and a con sometimes, you know? And you're like, I don't know where they're going with this. And that feels
like
good
Game
and
of
bad.
Thrones in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, I mean, you know, that's a whole nother episode, because I'm currently watching season 5 on HBO now, and I've read all the books, and you know, the first 3 books in that series are amazing. And this is coming from the guy that wrote the George R. R. Martin Is Not Your Bitch song, so yeah. I'm a big supporter of George R. R. Martin, but really, Feast of Crows and Dance of Dragons, I mean, those are both, I don't know how long Feast of Crows is, but Dance of Dragons is like 1,000 pages, and Feast of Crows is at least 600 or 700 pages.
That's
a long one too. And boy, not a lot happens in those books, and it's a lot. And I'm almost thinking they're doing a better job with the television series, because I feel like what they're doing with that is they're really streamlining a lot of what George R. Martin was doing.
It's
sort of like, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it would be boring television, I think. Not to get too into the books and too into the series to be spoilery, but I, again, I'm in the middle of season 5, and I'm like, I like what they're doing better here, because this is clearly not what they did in the book, but they're going in the same direction of the book, but they're cutting out a lot of the stuff that, in my opinion, didn't need to happen. It's like he introduces a bunch of characters in Dance of Dragons that really didn't need to be in there, or, you know, at least for the flow of the story. So I think a lot of times YA, and we'll throw television in there too, a lot of times they just streamline the story so it's a little easier to follow, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, you know, with that being said, what I'm going to pick is, I'm not quite done with it yet, but I'm currently reading in about 60% of the way through Mockingjay by Suzanne Collins, which is the final book in the Hunger Games trilogy. And I've had an interesting experience with that series, because I bought the Hunger Games when it was on sale for like $1.99. I think you could probably still get that for $1.99 as an ebook.
Oh yeah.
Because it is the first book in the series. And I had it sitting on my Kindle for quite a while. And I think it was when the first movie showed up on Netflix. And I'm like, you know what? I'll read that book and then I'll watch the movie. And so I've done that so far this season. So I read that, then watched it on Netflix. Then I read Catching Fire, then watched it on Netflix. And then I saw on Amazon Prime that Mockingjay Part 1 is on Amazon Prime to watch. And I'm like, you know what? I'll go and I'll finish the series now. So I'm about 3/4 of the way through the series. So my plan is to finish that book, watch Part 1 on Amazon, and then maybe actually go to the movies and see the one that's going to be out soon. As this airs, I think it'll already be out. So again, the same thing. Why I feel like it's a nice streamlined story, and I've really enjoyed the series quite a bit, and I've liked watching the movies, and as is often the case, I think the books are better than the movies, although I've enjoyed the movies too. But it's been an interesting experience, because I've literally watched the movie like the day after I finished the book. So the book is very fresh in my mind. Hmm. So I don't know if that's a pro or a con in terms of the experience, but I'm really looking forward to finishing it, watching the movies, and then finally watching one in the theater. And the other thing is, with a super popular series like this, kind of like, in my opinion anyway, kind of like The Martian, I feel like we had guests, I think on 3 episodes in a row, where people picked The Martian as their book choice, as their pick. And then because the movie was out, because a lot of people wanted to read it before the movie came out, and something like Ready Player One, which is massively popular. My experience with reading any of the massively popular books is like, oh yeah, I know why this is massively popular, because it's really good. You know, I think a lot of people take the opposite tack. It's like, it's okay. You know, but my experience is anytime there is a super massively popular science fiction or fantasy book or series, it almost always lives up to expectations for me. I don't know if your experience has been the same way.
It might be the writer's sort of brain too. You know, when I'm picking stuff up. I remember when I read The Hunger Games, and I was really resistant to picking it up because it was YA, and I'd had some bad experiences with YA at that point, and I was just like, oh, I don't want to read about another group of, you know, teenagers trying to, you know, and that's not that that's a bad story, but, you know, as an adult, you all can, different points are looking for different things to read. So I picked it up because it was on super sale on Kindle or something, same thing, and read the first book, bought the second, read the first book on a Saturday, couldn't put it down, blew through the second one, because bought it, and of course read that, and then read the third one. And I think I'd finished the entire series by Sunday night. And it was just, absolutely, I had the same thing, where it was like, okay, now I get why everybody is talking about this book. And I wonder sometimes if, I see writers do this a lot, where they'll see a book and it's like, oh, it's super popular, like Ready Player One or The Hunger Games. And you'll start, I'll see this at conventions where you'll have somebody up on a panel or, you know, on a show or something, and they'll say, well, you know, yes, it was very popular, but this is why these other books that are, you know, not as popular are much better. And these are the mistakes they've made. And it's like, you know, the one that they do that the most with is not a sci-fi book, but 50 Shades of Grey. And you'll hear people slam 50 Shades Grey. It's a great test to do if you're at a convention. You know, say 50 Shades Grey, and then people will just start with the hate, you know, the hate mail. But if you look at it, and you're looking at it from a writer or sort of a commercial sort of point of frame of mind, you can see why it's so popular. And I wonder if it's just a backlash to something being popular, where people just want to say, you know, maybe their expectations were higher, or maybe they, you know, maybe it's like they just want to hate on something. It's like the Kardashians.
Yes, it's the exact same thing. Well, I think that's, I think that's a great place to wrap it up. So, first of all, Christy, thank you for filling in for Patrick. I really saved our butt this week. So thank you for coming in. And before we do wrap it up, why don't you tell people about your books, about your website, about your Twitter, and all that kind of stuff?
Okay. So my first novel is Owl in the Japanese Circus. It is about it's getting sort of dubbed as sort of a female Indiana Jane, and it's about ex-archaeology graduate student Alex, otherwise known as Owl, who turns antiquities thief. And the first book starts with her not taking any supernatural jobs ever, and until a dragon makes her an offer she cannot refuse. And I'll just sort of leave that off there. The second book just came out in ebook, Owl in the City of Angels. And I've had some luck with that. Two more books were just scheduled in that series. So awesome. Those will be coming out next year and the following year. And I have another series coming out with Random House this summer, The Voodoo Killings. So it is a coming out May 10th. And it's about a voodoo practitioner living in Seattle who gets roped into a serial killer's a serial killer who's going around and killing zombies and practitioners in downtown Seattle, and she has to solve it before she becomes either a victim or the main suspect.
Awesome. Good. And why don't you throw out your website and your Twitter so people can...
Oh, yeah. ChristyCherish.com. Very easy. And at ChristyCherish at Twitter.
Yes, and that's Christy with a K.
Yes.
All right. Well, Christy, thank you so much again this week. For me, you can just follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And again, if you enjoy the show, consider becoming a patron, one of our patrons over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. All right, everybody. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?